Chapter 7. Nancy, May 13, 1915. Beside me, on my writing table, stands a bunch of peonies, the jolly round-faced pink peonies of the village garden. They were picked this afternoon in the garden of a ruined house at Gerbaville, a house so calcined and convulsed that, for epithets dire enough to fit it, one would have to borrow from a Hebrew prophet gloating over the fall of a city of idolaters. Since leaving Paris yesterday, we have passed through streets and streets of such murdered houses, through town after town spread out in its last writhings, and before the black holes that were homes, along the edge of the chasms that were streets, everywhere we have seen flowers and vegetables springing up in freshly raked and watered gardens. My pink peonies were not introduced to point the stale allegory of unconscious nature veiling man's havoc. They are put on my first page as a symbol of conscious human energy coming back to replant and rebuild the wilderness. Last March, in the Yargon, the towns we passed through seemed quite dead, but yesterday new life was budding everywhere. We were following another track of the invasion, one of the huge tiger scratches that the beast flung over the land last September, between Vitry-le-François and Bar-le-Duc. Etrepy, Pargny, Sermaise-les-Bains, Andernay, are the names of this group of victims. Sermaise a pretty watering place along wooded slopes, the others large villages fringed with farms, and all now mere scrofula splotches on the soft spring scene. But in many we heard the sound of hammers, and saw bricklayers and masons at work. Even in the most mortally stricken there were signs of returning life. Children playing among the stone heaps, and now and then a cautious older face peering out of a shed propped against the ruins. In one place an ancient tram car had been converted into a café, and labeled Restaurant des Ruins, and everywhere between the calcined walls the carefully combed gardens aligned their radishes and lettuce tops. From Bar-le-Duc we turned northeast, and as we entered the forest of Commercy we began to hear again the voice of the front. It was the warmest and stillest of May days, and in the clearing where we stopped for luncheon the familiar boom broke with a magnified loudness on the noonday hush. In the intervals between the crashes there was not a sound, but the gnat's hum in the moist sunshine, and the dryad call of the cuckoo from greener depths. At the end of the lane a few cavalrymen rode by in shabby blue, their horses' flanks glinting like ripe chestnuts. They stopped to chat, and accept some cigarettes, and when they had trotted off again the gnat, the cuckoo and the cannon took up their trio. The town of Commercy looked so undisturbed, that the cannonade rocking it might have been some unheeded echo of the hills. These frontier towns inured to the clash of war go about their business with what one might call stolidity, if there were not finer, and truer, names for it. In Commercy, to be sure, there is little business to go about just now save that connected with the military occupation, but the peaceful look of the sunny sleepy streets made one doubt if the fighting line was really less than 5 miles away. Yet the French, with an odd perversion of race vanity, still persist in speaking of themselves as a nervous and impressionable people. This afternoon, on the road to Gerbaville, we were again in the track of the September invasion. Over all the slopes now cool with spring foliage the battle rocked backward and forward during those burning autumn days, and every mile of the struggle has left its ghastly traces. The fields are full of wooden crosses which the plowshare makes a circuit to avoid. Many of the villages have been partly wrecked, and here and there an isolated ruin marks the nucleus of a fiercer struggle. But the landscape, in its first sweet leafiness, is so alive with plowing and sowing, and all the natural tasks of spring, that the war scars seem like traces of a long past woe, and it was not till a bend of the road brought us in sight of Gerbaville that we breathed again the choking air of present horror. Gerbaville, stretched out at ease on its slopes above the Meurthe, must have been a happy place to live in. The streets slanted up between scattered houses in gardens to the great Louis-Yves Chateau above the town, and the church that balanced it. So much one can reconstruct from the first glimpse across the valley, but when one enters the town all perspective is lost in chaos. Gerbeville has taken to herself the title of the martyr town, an honor to which many sister victims might dispute her claim. But as a sensational image of havoc it seems improbable that any can surpass her. Her ruins seem to have been simultaneously vomited up from the depths and hurled down from the skies, as though as he had perished in some monstrous clash of earthquake and tornado, and it fills one with a cold despair to know that this double destruction was no accident of nature, but a piously planned and methodically executed human deed. From the opposite heights the poor little garden girt town was shelled like a steel fortress. Then, when the Germans entered, a fire was built in every house, and at the nicely timed right moment one of the explosive tabloids which the fearless Teuton carries about for his land Lusitanias was tossed on each hearth. It was all so well done that one wonders almost apologetically for German thoroughness that any of the human rats escaped from their holes, but some did, and were neatly spitted on lurking bayonets. One old woman, hearing her son's death cry, rashly looked out of her door. A bullet instantly laid her low among her phloxes and lilies, and there, in her little garden, her dead body was dishonored. It seemed singularly appropriate, in such a scene, to read above a blackened doorway the sign colon monuments funebres, and to observe that the house the doorway once belonged to had formed the angle of a lane, called the Ruelle des Orphelins. At one end of the main street of Gerbeville there once stood a charming house, of the sober old Lorraine pattern, with low door, deep roof and ample gables. It was in the garden of this house that my pink peonies were picked for me by its owner, Mr. Lige, a former mayor of Gerbeville, who witnessed all the horrors of the invasion. Mr. Lige is now living in a neighbor's cellar, his own being fully occupied by the debris of his charming house. He told us the story of the 3 days of the German occupation, how he and his wife and niece, and the niece's babies, took to their cellar while the Germans set the house on fire, and how, peering through a door into the stable yard, they saw that the soldiers suspected they were within, and were trying to get at them. Luckily the incendiaries had heaped wood and straw all around the outside of the house, and the blaze was so hot that they could not reach the door. Between the arch of the doorway and the door itself was a half-moon opening, and Mr. Lige and his family, during 3 days and three nights, broke up all the barrels in the cellar and threw the bits out through the opening to feed the fire in the yard. Finally, on the third day, when they began to be afraid that the ruins of the house would fall in on them, they made a dash for safety. The house was on the edge of the town, and the women and children managed to get away into the country, but Mr. Lige was surprised in his garden by a German soldier. He made a rush for the high wall of the adjoining cemetery, and scrambling over it slipped down between the wall and a big granite cross. The cross was covered with the hideous wire and glass wreaths dear to French mourners, and with these opportune mementos Mr. Lige roofed himself in, lying wedged in his narrow hiding place from 3 in the afternoon till night, and listening to the voices of the soldiers who were hunting for him among the gravestones. Luckily it was their last day at Gerbeville, and the German retreat saved his life. Even in Gerbeville we saw no worse scene of destruction than the particular spot in which the ex-mayor stood, while he told his story. He looked about him at the heaps of blackened brick and contorted iron. "See, this was my dining room," he said. There were some good old paneling on the walls, and some fine prints that had been a wedding present to my grandfather. He led us into another black pit. "See, this was our sitting room. You see what a view we had." He sighed, and added philosophically, "I suppose we were too well off. I even had an electric light out there on the terrace, to read my paper by on summer evenings. Yes, we were too well off. That was all." Meanwhile all the town had been red with horror, flame and shot and tortures unnameable, and at the other end of the long street, a woman, a sister of charity, had held her own like Sieur Gabrielle at Clermont-en-Argonne, gathering her flock of old men and children about her, and interposing her short stout figure between them and the fury of the Germans. We found her in her hospice, a ruddy, indomitable woman who related with a quiet indignation more thrilling than invective the hideous details of the bloody 3 days. But that already belongs to the past, and at present she is much more concerned with the task of clothing and feeding Gerbeviller. For 2/3 of the population have already home, that is what they call the return to this desert. Why, you see, Sieur Julie explained, there are the crops to sow, the gardens to tend. They had to come back. The government is building wooden shelters for them, and people will surely send us beds and linen. Of course they would, one felt as one listened. Evie boots, 2 boots for field laborers. We want them for women as well as men like these. Sieur Julie, smiling, turned up a hobnailed sole. I have directed all the work on our hospice farm myself. All the women are working in the fields. We must take the place of the men. And I seem to see my pink peonies flowering in the very prints of her sturdy boots. May 14th. Nancy, the most beautiful town in France, has never been as beautiful as now. Coming back to it last evening from a round of ruins, one felt as if the humbler sisters sacrificed to spare it were pleading with one not to forget them in the contemplation of its dearly bought perfection. The last time I looked out on the great architectural setting of the Place Stanislas was on a hot July evening, the evening of the national fete. The square and the avenues leading to it swarmed with people, and as darkness fell the balanced lines of arches and palaces sprang out in many colored light. Garlands of lamps looped the arcades leading into the Place de la Carrière. Peacock-colored fires flared from the Arch of Triumph, long curves of radiance beat like wings over the thickets of the park, the sculptures of the fountains, the brown and gold foliation of John Damer's great gates. And under this roofing of light was the murmur of a happy crowd carelessly celebrating the tradition of half-forgotten victories. Now, at sunset, all life ceases in Nancy and veil after veil of silence comes down on the deserted plus and its empty perspectives. Last night by 9 the few lingering lights in the streets had been put out, every window was blind, and the moonless night lay over the city like a canopy of velvet. Then, from some remote point, the arc of a searchlight swept the sky, laid a fugitive pallor on darkened palace fronts, a gleam of gold on invisible gates, trembled across the black vault and vanished, leaving it still blacker. When we came out of the darkened restaurant on the corner of the square, and the iron curtain of the entrance had been hastily dropped on us, we stood in such complete night that it took a waiter's friendly hand to guide us to the curbstone. Then, as we grew used to the darkness, we saw it lying still more densely under the colonnade of the Place de la Carrière and the clipped trees beyond. The ordered masses of architecture became august, the spaces between them immense, and the black sky faintly strewn with stars seemed to overarch an enchanted city. Not a footstep sounded, not a leaf rustled, not a breath of air drew under the arches. And suddenly, through the dumb night, the sound of the cannon began. May 14th. Luncheon with the general staff in an old bourgeois house of a little town as sleepy as Ranford. In the warm walled gardens everything was blooming at once. Laburnums, lilacs, red hawthorn, banksia roses and all the pleasant border plants that go with box and lavender. Never before did the flowers answer the spring roll call with such a rush. Upstairs, in the Empire bedroom which the general has turned into his study, it was amusingly incongruous to see the sturdy provincial furniture littered with war maps, trench plans, aeroplane photographs and all the documentation of modern war. Through the windows bees hummed, the garden rustled, and one felt, close by, behind the walls of other gardens, the untroubled continuance of a placid and orderly bourgeois life. We started early for Mausson on the Moselle, the ruined hill fortress that gives its name to the better-known town at its foot. Our road ran below the long range of the Rancauren, The line of hills curving southeast from Pont de Mousson to St. Nicolas du Port. All through this pleasant, broken country the battle shook and swayed last autumn, but few signs of those days are left except the wooden crosses in the fields. No troops are visible, and the pictures of war that made the Argonne so tragic last March are replaced by peaceful rustic scenes. On the way to Mousson the road is overhung by an Italian-looking village clustered about a hilltop. It marks the exact spot at which, last August, the German invasion was finally checked and flung back, and the Muse of History points out that on this very hill has long stood a memorial shaft inscribed. Here, in the year 362, Jovinus defeated the Teutonic hordes. A little way up the ascent to Mousson we left the motor behind a bit of rising ground. The road is raked by the German lines, and stray pedestrians, unless in a group, are less liable than a motor to have a shell spent on them. We climbed under a driving gray sky which swept gusts of rain across our road. In the lee of the castle we stopped to look down at the valley of the Moselle, the slate roofs of Pont de Mousson, and the broken bridge which once linked together the two sides of the town. Nothing but the wreck of the bridge showed that we were on the edge of war. The wind was too high for firing, and we saw no reason for believing that the wood just behind the hospice roof at our feet was seamed with German trenches and bristling with guns, or that from every slope across the valley the eye of the cannon sleeplessly glared. But there the Germans were, drawing an iron ring about three sides of the watchtower, and as one peered through an embrasure of the ancient walls one gradually found oneself reliving the sensations of the little medieval burg as it looked out on some earlier circle of besiegers. The longer one looked, the more oppressive and menacing the invisibility of the foe became. There they are, and there and there. We strained our eyes obediently, but saw only calm hillsides, dozing farms. It was as if the earth itself were the enemy, as if the hordes of evil were in the clods and grass blades. Only one conical hill close by showed an odd artificial patterning, like the work of huge ants who had scarred it with criss-cross ridges. We were told that these were French trenches, but they looked much more like the harmless traces of a prehistoric camp. Suddenly an officer, pointing to the west of the trenched hill said, "Do you see that farm? It lay just below, near the river, and so close that good eyes could easily have discerned people or animals in the farmyard, if there had been any, but the whole place seemed to be sleeping the sleep of bucolic peace." "They are there," the officer said, "and the innocent vignette framed by my field glass." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.